All right.
Yeah.
Whoa, listen to that echo. How's everyone doing? Really? That's the best you can do. How's everyone doing?
Yeah.
All right. So thank you everybody for coming to my presentation. My name is John O'Bacon and I work at Canonical as the Ubuntu Community Manager. How many people here use Ubuntu, by the way? You're all beautiful, handsome individuals. So a bit of background about who I am. As I mentioned, I work at Canonical on Ubuntu. I've been working at Canonical now for about 7 years. And I have a team of five people who work in different parts of the community. George Castro, who everyone should know if you don't know, being one of the said rock stars. I also do community management consulting on the side for big companies who want to build communities either internally or externally. And I'm just really passionate about communities. I think communities are one of the most beautiful aspects of being a human being, when we can create things that are bigger than the individual, that are bigger than the singular. So I wrote a book called The Art of Community, which is available under a Creative Commons license as well as on Amazon and other bookshops, and run the Community Leadership Summit every year. So I just want to set some expectations first of all. Last time I was at Ohio Linux Fest, a friend of mine called Dan, who's on the Linux Link Tech Show, I made him moon the audience as part of my presentation. Apparently this caused a little bit of controversy in the following year. There was very strict guidelines around no nudity in presentations. So I just want to assure you all that there's going to be no bare bottoms or anything like that in this presentation. And to apologize, I wanted to show you the picture of this duck. Anyway, for a long time now we've been hearing this, right? Blah, blah, blah is the year of the Linux desktop. I mean, I remember hearing this back in like 2004. I mean, I remember hearing it back in 1999. This is the year of the Linux desktop. And as somebody who is interested in the Linux desktop and the Linux desktop succeeding, you know, it's something that it has become a running joke. And what this really means is, when are we going to get over the chasm, right? The chasm being that sliver of technology adoption where technology goes from being something that early adopters, that people who are passionate about technology, people like us, are using, to becoming something that the general populace are going to use. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later on. But that year of the Linux desktop is really about that sense of getting over that hurdle, which is a really complicated chasm to get over. It is the death of many software companies. One of the things I've learned is that, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this as well, is great technology is not enough for success. You know, if you have an awesome product, it doesn't mean you're going to be successful. You've got to have all these other different pieces in place as well. And one of the things that we're working towards is building this convergence story in Ubuntu. This is a single ubiquitous operating system that runs across desktops, televisions, phones, and tablets. Maybe in the future there'll be toasters, refrigerators, I don't know, whatever. So we're building out this story, and I just want to talk about how we got from being the Ubuntu of 2004, which was a desktop and a server, to how we've got to this convergence vision and what we're doing to build this out. Because I think there's a lot of really interesting technology that's going on here. So this story starts back when I looked like this. As you can see, I used to have hair, believe it or not. When I was about 21, my hair started growing inwards and coming out my toes. This is when around this time I joined Canonical, and I was really getting interested in working in open source as my career. And back then, we used to build Ubuntu for these things. I miss these days a little bit. I mean, it's cool to have all these TVs and tablets and laptops and all this kind of stuff, but I miss these beige boxes where I'd put all these different cards in and I'd be reading forums about whether this particular card is going to work with this particular driver, whatever else. So we were around this time, we were building for these big beige boxes, and of course a lot of us were drinking like Tab Clear and stuff like that as we were going through. I miss that as well. And the desktop pretty much looked like this. It was, frankly, crap. Retrospectively, it was pretty limited in how it worked, but at the time it was really exciting because the foundations of building something that was really good was there. I remember back in those days, as I'm sure many of you do who've been around Linux for a long time, just the concept of having a display working was exciting. You know, the first time you got X running was pretty exciting. So to build a desktop that automated all that kind of stuff, to a point where you could throw up a desktop, even though that desktop was very simplistic and didn't generally serve the wider needs of technology users, was really exciting foundation. So we had this on the desktop, And we were also building towards the server as well. And we were very much going after kind of file print back then. Frankly, back then, Canonical wasn't really a server company. It was, the server was something that we did, but it was kind of an afterthought to a reasonable degree. I'm not really going to be talking so much about the server in this presentation. We'll be talking about the client side stuff. If you've got any questions about all the cloud orchestration work that we're doing and Juju and all that kind of stuff, you want to talk to the guy with the obnoxious orange hat on, because there is a really exciting story going on with cloud right now with Ubuntu.
Whole server talk today.
Yeah, whole server talk today. So back then, Canonical was quite a different company as well. We had this logo for a start, which I think someone cobbled together in their lunch break. The company looked like this. It was pretty small. This is a picture that was taken in Plymouth. That's me. No hair at this point. Next to me is a guy called Ben Collins, who introduced me to the Jaeger bomb. If you ever meet this guy in a bar and he says, "Fancy a drink?" Say no, trust me. Just say no, because like bad things happen when you drink with that guy. And then there's this South African guy who's got some money in his pocket. So we were a very small company, very focused, very engineering heavy company. And as time went on, we were like building out the community and you know, my job at the time, I was around this time, I just started building a team. So it was myself and there was Daniel Holback on the team. George was, were you in this? Yeah, George was in on the team. We were just starting to get an idea of, you know, the community is not just something we want one person working on. This is something that we need to build out across all aspects of what we're doing in Ubuntu. The community is still at the heart of everything that we do. There is debate, and I'm sure some of you have seen it on the internet, about how committed Canonical is to community. One thing I can assure you is that Canonical is as passionate about the community as it is today as it was back then. If it wasn't, I wouldn't be working at Canonical. I'm not going to work for a company that doesn't care about communities. Why would I go and work somewhere else? So there is a strong passion about it, but at this time we're just starting to figure out what we wanted to work on. Because there's always way more things that we need to work on than we have time for. So we have to prioritize where we focus on, which bits of the community we focus on, and how that meets our wider goals. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later on. So our community started growing more and more. We were having Ubuntu Developer Summits every 6 months in various far-flung places. This is a picture from Seville. And the community were participating in how we built Ubuntu, primarily on the desktop side, but on the server side as well. And our product started changing. It started looking a little bit like this. It had a little bit more identity to it, because we wanted people to look at it and say, that's Ubuntu. We didn't want to lock other people out from building on Ubuntu. We didn't want to dominate the Linux industry and only have people using Ubuntu. But we wanted to make sure that when people use it, they know it's Ubuntu, and there's a level of expectation set that's associated with the brand. But around this time, essentially what we had was a desktop that was basically used by everyone in the Linux community, most people. It was, you go to conferences and everyone would have an Ubuntu laptop. We got to a point where our goal was to be the choice of the Linux enthusiast. That was the very first time I joined Canonical. That was the stated goal. We want to be the choice of the Linux enthusiast. The challenge that we had was this chasm, which is, okay, Ubuntu is the choice of the Linux enthusiast. How does that translate into a sustainable business that we can use to continue to move forward and support Ubuntu? Because around that time, most of the funding that was coming into Ubuntu was from Mark Shuttleworth. And while that is a revenue stream, it's not a scalable revenue stream. Okay? So we're at this point where the early adopters and the innovators were pretty much using Ubuntu. But we needed to get over that chasm to get people like my mum and dad using it, to make it something, a general purpose technology that people can use. For me, this really resonated. One of the reasons why I wanted to work at Canonical and work on Ubuntu is because, much as I believe that we talk about open source and free software all the time, but we always talk about it within the context of code. And the Free Software Foundation, who do phenomenal work, are primarily focused on the freeness that's associated with things that you can download. It's code, it's images, it's music, it's whatever else. For me, freedom doesn't mean anything if people can't use the technology. You can have a completely impossible, complex system to use that's completely free software. And we have a lot of that in open source. But to me, that isn't real freedom. Real freedom is technology that anyone can use, that people who are not tech savvy, that kids and the elderly and people who don't care about computers, they just want to use it as part of their organization or as part of their home life. that they can use. And that to me is the purest essence of freedom, is that when we can take Linux and we can package it up into a form that regular people can use, that is when technology really enables people. That's when people have access to education and healthcare and all kinds of stuff via open source. So for me, this was exactly what we needed to do. I'm a Linux nerd, and Ubuntu was satisfying my requirements, but getting it over that chasm was the next step. But fundamentally, to do this, we needed to challenge ourselves. Getting over that chasm wasn't a different choice of packages. It wasn't switching from GNOME to KDE or something else like that. It was looking at essentially everything that we're doing and assessing how we can get over that chasm from all different angles. It was design, marketing, sales, all of those different pieces, how they fit together. One of the conclusions that I came to around this time was that we were always talking about Ubuntu within the context of a project, you know, which is, it's a shared commons that everyone can feed into, but it's a project. It's almost like a hobby, if you will. And for a lot of us, it is a hobby. For people who don't work professionally in open source, something like Ubuntu or another distribution is a hobby that people can participate in. But one of the things around that time was we started thinking of it within the context of a product. That is, something that you can give to an organization that they can ship on hardware. Now, we'd always been doing this. We've been working with OEMs and whoever else. But thinking about Ubuntu within the context of a product, which is building something that other people can use as well, I think was a fundamental change in what happened to Ubuntu. And this caused some frustration, you know. I'm sure there's some of you in here today who were frustrated the fact that Ubuntu started focusing on simplifying the desktop and all that kind of stuff with Unity. But I think it was really important to be able to widen that base of people who can use it. So we knew that we were moving forward to building something that was going to be of general purpose use, that was going to be useful and interesting for Linux enthusiasts, but could also be useful and interesting for non-Linux enthusiasts as well. But it was critical that our philosophy guides our way forward with this. When I joined Canonical, I'll never forget my job interview. I interviewed in Mark Shuttleworth's kitchen because his flat was down the road from the office, and the office had like 10 people in it. So a lot of people would go and work at his place because they couldn't fit in the office. And I interviewed in his kitchen, which was the most nerve-wracking experience of my life. And he said very clearly, Jono, as you work in the community, I want the philosophy of Ubuntu to guide us. You know, Ubuntu will always be free. There will not be a special enterprise version and a crippled community version. It will be available in everybody's language. It will be accessible. All those different pieces that form our philosophy back then. I saw him a few weeks ago at a sprint, and he said a very similar thing, is that our philosophy needs to guide us moving forward. We can't compromise on that. So, and this is complex. From a community management perspective, there are some people, our philosophy is, it's not like it's one set of definitions. It's, you know, people have different ideas about what accessible means and what in your language means. So we've done our best to stay within this. And I think, by and large, this guides us as we move forward. So we started focusing on the desktop and refine all these different aspects of the desktop. And then we talked about how we could build a convergence strategy around this as well. And we talked at a UDS in Orlando, and Mark presented the notion of Ubuntu running on all these different devices. Wouldn't it be interesting if Ubuntu could run on televisions and tablets and phones and things like that? What are the challenges that we face in terms of design, in terms of engineering, in terms of people being able to get access to that technology and put it in their hands? So we started throwing around these ideas, and one of the things that became clear to me was this is what's going to get us over the chasm, because if just focusing on the desktop alone, being the choice of the Linux enthusiast, is not enough to get us over that chasm, to make it sustainable, then building something that is accessible by lots of people across lots of different devices is more sustainable. It's a lot more ambitious as well. And that's one of the things that's been really interesting and meaty about getting involved in this challenge. So the first thing we ended up shipping was the TV, or the first thing we ended up showing off was the TV. And we showed this off at CES in Las Vegas. And this is when Unity, as this environment that we build, this user experience that we build to unify all these different devices, this is when the concept of unification really started being visible in people's eyes. A lot of those design decisions, I think, when it was just on the desktop, didn't make any sense. But when the TV happened, people could see, the colors look the same, and the font looks similar, and the launcher on the side looks kind of similar. I see how the two look like Ubuntu. And that was essentially the goal. Which, incidentally, for the design team, is one of the things I'm really proud about, is if you know, for a designer to sit down and build a set of reusable design patterns that can can be applicable across all of these different devices, is a phenomenal design challenge. It's not like they come up with a design pattern and then they only apply it to the desktop. For them to have sign-off on a design pattern that can be used, it needs to work across all of these different form factors, which is a really complex challenge, and the team have done a good job with that, I think. So that was the first thing that we showed off. The second thing was Ubuntu for Android. This is where you can take a device, like an Ubuntu phone or an Android phone. You can dock it, and then it boots a full Ubuntu desktop. This is something that we can do in large part due to our partnership with Linaro. So to me, the exciting thing about this was not the fact that you can boot the desktop. That technically is interesting, but it's not that hard to do. The thing that was interesting for me is that the entire Debian archive that is built against Ubuntu runs on that device. That was the real challenge, is having all of those applications that can run. So you can go to the Ubuntu Software Center and load anything, and it will run on an ARM chip that's running on your device as well. And then on the 2nd of January this year, which is just at, this is basically the last time I think most of us slept, we announced the Ubuntu phone. And I've got one up here, so if you see me wandering around OLF today and tomorrow, if you want to come and check it out, I can give you a demo. The Ubuntu phone has sparked a tremendous amount of interest. In my 7 years at Canonical, I've never seen any level of interest in anything we're doing as I've seen with the Ubuntu phone. I think part of what's interesting is that it's a real David and Goliath challenge, right? A lot of people said, how are you going to compete in an industry that's dominated by Google and Apple? But if you look at the cell phone industry, just look at it 4 years ago. It was Nokia, and it was Palm, and BlackBerry. Remember them? So there is the opportunity to change things around. And one of the things that I've heard a lot of feedback from, and we've heard from OEMs and carriers and customers and things like that, is the thing that's attractive about Ubuntu is not just the user experience, that it feels more refined, it feels a nicer experience than something like Android. It's that the Android community, and I certainly don't mean to tear down anything the Android community are doing. I think they're doing fantastic work. But the Android community is not the Ubuntu community. I think the Ubuntu community is a lot more open. It's a lot more accessible than the Android community. A bunch of customers that we've talked to have said that it's really hard to get a patch into Android. It can take months and months and months and months. So I didn't realize that one of the attractive aspects of Ubuntu for these device manufacturers and carriers is not just the fact that it's not just the user experience and the fact that it could be cheaper. It's the community. The community is actually a selling point, which was really interesting from my perspective. It's also caused a lot of work from my perspective. And then we announced the tablet. And at this point, people were thinking, what's next? We're going to have a tricorder? And the key thing about this is that what we're building here is a ubiquitous platform that runs across all these different devices. So it's not just that we have these different UIs that on these different devices. It's that what's running on my phone in my pocket is the same OS that will run on the tablet, on the desktop. It's the same Unity code base. It's the same set of applications. It's the same application development framework. It's the same packaging model. It's the same app confinement. All of that stuff is exactly the same. So everything that we do on the phone to build the phone will benefit each of these other form factors. And the thing that connects this, a lot of people ask, how do you sync? Like, do you have applications to sync your data and all that kind of stuff? Well, that's where Ubuntu One comes in. Is Ubuntu One is this cloud service where all of your data can flow between your different devices. So you're sat on the bus on your Ubuntu phone, you buy a song or download a song, it'll save it to your Ubuntu One storage, and it'll be automatically synced with your TV, with your desktop, and everything else. So everything's connected. And as I mentioned, the cloud is a key piece of what we're building out as well, but I'm not going to really focus on that as much. So let's talk about the phone. I'm going to show you a really quick video that's got sound, but you're not going to hear it. Actually, yeah, yes you are. You're going to hear everything. Sorry for the nudity. All right, I'm going to show you a quick video that shows the Ubuntu phone and how it works. Thank you. free mic. So that gives you an idea of what Ubuntu for Phones looks like. And everything you see in that video, pretty about 95% of that is read. It's already written. It's available on my phone right now. It's a really slick and sexy user experience. And like I say, it maps across all of these different devices. So let me just take a quick few key points about the phone. The first thing is that before you even unlock the thing, we want it to have this attractive, personalized first glance. We have this thing called the infographic, which is in the middle, which can show you how many Fitbit steps you may have walked, or how many photos you took today, how many Twitter direct messages you may not have read yet, how many text messages you probably had. I'm sure it's the same thing for you folks. When you're in a bar and you're hanging out with your friends, you just keep checking your phone to see if you've had any messages or anything like that. This provides a really quick first glance of how you can do that. But then the other thing is that we have this interesting model where we don't require any buttons on an Ubuntu phone, because hardware manufacturers want a low bill of materials. Buttons cost money. So we use the edges to interact with it, and this is consistent across all of these different devices. So as an example, if you swipe out from the left, you see the launcher. This is familiar, for those of you who use Ubuntu on the desktop, it looks almost identical. And in fact, the desktop, as I say, will ship the same code base in the future. So you have the launcher on the side, which has frequently used applications, your quick list, things like that. On the bottom side, when you slide up within an application, this is how you access tools. So if you have the gallery app open, you slide up from the bottom, there's an edit button, you can change, you can remove red eye and crop it and things like that. One of the key things here as well is that we focus on content. So content is absolutely key. This is, one of the things that we've worked on is making sure that all the clutter on a phone or on a desktop or anything else is moved out of the way, even to the point where we've thinned down the scroll bars that you've probably seen on the Ubuntu desktop. We actually focus even more content in the gallery app now. That toolbar at the top, that vanishes. So you can slide down from the top to access your indicators and your common settings and then multitask on the right side. So we announced this at CES in Vegas, and it was a week of pure, unbridled insanity. I've never seen anything like it. We were just completely inundated with people. Will.i.am came over to the booth. MC Hammer was apparently going to come over to the booth, but he didn't show up. I guess he couldn't touch it. So we announced it, and one of the things, at this point, from our team's perspective, is like, okay, how do we interface this bold vision with our community? And this is where, for me, the fun really started. So one of the key focal points here was we want to make sure that people can participate in the Ubuntu convergence story as much as they can as other aspects of Ubuntu as well. So we started focusing on these things. Ubuntu phone, tablet, all of this, fully open code and bugs. You can go and download it. You can install it on your device. You can access all of the bugs. You can fix bugs. You can comment on bugs. All in all of its gory detail. We have transparent blueprinting. Anybody can propose a feature. You can discuss those. Those are our quarterly planning meetings, which are online UDS sessions. They're accessible to everybody. Everybody's welcome. We do it on Google Plus Hangouts and IRC. We have open communication. All of our mailing lists, all of the discussion is out in the open. It's out on IRC. It's out on the mailing lists. Everything, Mir, Unity, our app confinement story, all of those different pieces are all public. And the critical point is daily images. We have, so the software that I'm running on here, if any of you have got a Galaxy Nexus or a Nexus 4 device, then you can use a single command and install Ubuntu on your device. And you can update it over the air from Ubuntu as well. So you can access all of this right now. Even though it's not finished yet, you can access it. So we started seeing more and more people participating, but one of the things that we wanted to focus on as well was working with the XDA community. When we kicked off Ubuntu Touch, the XDA community got access to they downloaded some of these touch images and they started bringing them to different devices. For those of you who are unfamiliar with XDA, this is a big community of people who are interested in essentially modding phones. So they work on CyanogenMod and all kinds of Android-related pieces. They set up a forum, because XDA is a forum, basically. They set up a sub-forum for Ubuntu Touch, and within 2 days, there was 1,500 posts to this forum. It was just phenomenal. Then people started porting it to different handsets and different images. And so I put a guy on my team, Daniel Holbach. I said to him, look, I want to make sure that when these people do this work, that we can easily flow it to people who want to test it on their phones. Because originally, you could get you know, this image set up on your device. So for example, if you have an S3, you could get Ubuntu on your device, but it required a lot of farting around with installing these images and configuring a file system and doing all this kind of stuff. So Daniel's task was to be able to bring all that into the same tool that we use to flash these two different devices, the Galaxy Nexus and the Nexus 4, and we have that right now. We sponsored the XDA Dev Conference, which was in Miami a few weeks ago, went and spoke there, and we have a really great relationship with XDA. I cannot speak more highly of that community. They're a phenomenal, phenomenal group of people. So we have, you know, from that community and working with XDA, we have 45 working handsets that you can put Ubuntu on. There's 30 of those handsets are in progress right now, 21 different brands, over 6,000 posts in the forum. This is the idea here is that, again, everybody should get access to the technology, and this makes it easier for carriers and OEMs and people like that to be able to play with it. So if you go to this page, wiki.ubuntu.com/touch/devices, you'll be able to go and check out which devices are there. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about app development. As I mentioned earlier on, one of the complexities of being a community manager is there is always too much stuff to do. You never have enough time to do everything. And in thinking about how strategically we were going to move forward with Ubuntu, one conclusion that I came to for the team was we have to make app development a priority. The reason for that is because when people build apps and they can get them into Ubuntu, that makes Ubuntu an attractive and exciting developer platform. It makes an exciting platform for consumers because they've got a load of different apps that they can use. And that in turn makes it an exciting platform for OEMs and carriers because the functionality just is growing and growing and growing. The difficulty here is that this is basically how app development works, right? The broad goal is to have an idea in your head and to get to a point where you can put it on someone's phone or on someone's desktop or on someone's tablet, whatever else. And you go through these different phases. You need to pick tools. You need to develop the knowledge to be able to write that software. You need to have a support network where you can ask questions about things you're unsure about. You need to be able to package that software easily. And then you need to be able to publish it easily. The simple reality is that beforehand, this really sucked on Ubuntu. It really sucked. And the reason why it sucked is because we had all the different ingredients. But each one of those different ingredients didn't really do a stellar job. And you really needed to know a lot about how those different ingredients worked and fit together to be able to achieve success. So beforehand, let's quickly run through it. Tools. OK, I can write my app. What do I write it in? Well, you can use Qt, and you can use GTK, and you can use WX Windows, and you can use any one of a thousand other different toolkits. TickleTK. You can use all of these different things. Where do I find knowledge? Well, you've got to go to, if you want to write apps in GTK, well, you have to go to the GTK website. We don't have a central knowledge base, because we can't build knowledge for all of these different toolkits. Where do I find help? Well, you know, you can go to all of these different mailing lists and forums and whatever else. We have Ask Ubuntu, which is our central place to ask questions about Ubuntu, but there's only some developers on there, and they're all experiencing different things. Packaging. Oh, you want to get your app into Ubuntu? You need to be a Debian developer. You know, you need to be able to, first of all, build a Debian package, which is non-trivial. And then to get it into the archive, you need to either become an Ubuntu developer or a Debian developer, or you need to be able to know an Ubuntu or Debian developer to get it in. And you can only release your application every 6 months, because that's how Ubuntu ships apps. So and then publishing, well, you know, we reasonably solved that. We have the Ubuntu Software Center where you can download stuff. So all of these different pieces made application development for Ubuntu really complicated. So we sat down and we said, how can we fix all of these different things? And there's been a huge amount of work focused on this that has been solidified literally in the last week. To provide an overview, we knew that we need to build an SDK. You need to be able to go to a website, developer.ubuntu.com, and download an SDK and be able to write apps in a defined set of technologies. So with the Ubuntu SDK, if you go to developer.ubuntu.com, you can write apps in either Qt and QML. QML is this really neat declarative language that you can use with JavaScript. It makes writing apps really easy. You can create really fluid, beautiful animated interfaces. Everything that we have on the phone pretty much is written in Qt and QML. HTML5, obviously. This is the direction a lot of people are writing apps in. All of those apps that are written for other platforms in HTML5 or as a generic HTML5 app can be easily ported or brought over. We need OpenGL support so people can run their games. But then we also have online services. If you run a website, you can add a little bit of code to your website, or we can add code to Ubuntu to be able to integrate that website into the phone or into the tablet and whatever else. So you can integrate messages into the messaging menu. You can add a launcher item to it, things like that. And then scopes. Scopes are, when you open up the Ubuntu Dash, this is where you get content. And it can search all kinds of different online services, and you can present content to people in different ways. In 13.04, we had like a very limited set of scopes in Ubuntu. There's about 15. We've completely rebuilt that. We now have a smart scope service that's going to ship about 80 different scopes for all these different pieces of content, Wikipedia, open clip art, things like that. So we decided to settle on Qt and QML as the SDK, and then we built support for these other technologies. You can load that SDK up. It's got a full ID, full debugger, all the rest of it. We built a component set for QML, so all Ubuntu apps look the same. You can write an app in HTML5 in QML. They all look the same. All available within this IDE, where you can go and create a new project, and you can create a new project, and you can generate any one of these different applications and get started. The second piece was knowledge. Knowledge and support. So we have developer.ubuntu.com right now, which provides a place where you can go and you can get started writing your app in QML, HTML5, one of the scopes. We're currently in the process of redeveloping this right now, because one of the problems we had is, you know, API documentation is all over the web. So we're integrating all that into the site. We have more tutorials and guides, simplified support channels. We have cookbooks, which are the most commonly asked questions on Ask Ubuntu. Based upon the number of upvotes and whether that question was approved, it automatically gets pulled into a cookbook. So this is, do you remember those O'Reilly cookbooks? Like, I started out with a Python cookbook. It's just like that, but for all of these different technologies. And then easy publishing. Now, what I mean by easy publishing is that whole thing about having to build a Debian package and upload it. Problem with Debian packages for app developers have a number of problems. One is it's hard to build a package. Two is it has something called maintainer scripts, which means that a package can conceivably do things as root when it's installed in your system. And the third issue is that we didn't have any kind of app confinement in Ubuntu. So every app that was submitted to Ubuntu needed a full code review, even for a point version change, which meant that the review time for an application, in many cases, could take weeks. So what we've done is, to solve this problem, we've built a new packaging format called Qlik, which is completely open source. It's basically a zip file with some metadata in it. We built full app confinement into Ubuntu, so you can write an app that does really naughty things, and Ubuntu won't run it, won't allow it to do those things. That means we don't need to require code review. Qlik packages don't have maintainer scripts, so it's really easy to generate a package. You can press a button in the Ubuntu SDK, and it generates a Qlik package. You just specify what permissions your package needs, and then the review process is reviewing those permissions and checking that, you know, copyright and metadata is in there. That's taken the review time from, in many cases, 2 or 3 weeks down to about 10 minutes to get your app in. That Qlik package also, you know how you have to do an apt-get update and you have to rebuild your whole dependency, the whole locally cached dependency list, and it can take 2 minutes to do that? You can't do that on the phone. So Qlik packages, there's no dependency tracking. You just say, you require this SDK. Now, that can be the Ubuntu SDK. It could be a different SDK for a different platform. And the package list is on the server. So that means on my phone, as each of these Qlik packages have been coming through, they just appear. There's no apt-get update or anything like that. Just to be clear, the core system of Ubuntu still uses Debian packages, because for building operating systems, you really want to use apt and you want to use all that kind of stuff. But for app developers, we now have a situation where you can go, you can generate a Qlik package with a single Qlik, you can go to developer.ubuntu.com, you can upload it, and it can be in the store within 15 minutes. So this has been a real critical piece of how we've been building this out. A good example of this as well, about how this has been, how everything's been kind of pulling together, is what we call the Core Apps Project. So when we announced the phone on the 2nd of of January, we also said, we want our community to be part of building this story out. This is not something where Canonical does all the work and community members are not allowed to be able to participate and can't help building all of this. So we basically said, if you are a QML developer and you're interested in writing the core set of applications, this is the 11 apps, it's you know, what we call ritual apps. It's calendar, calculator, weather, RSS reader, terminal, all those kinds of things. If you can help and you're interested in helping, then fill in this form and we'll get in touch with you. We had 1,500 people fill that form in who wanted to help out with Ubuntu. Now, to be fair, a lot of those people had a lot more enthusiasm than experience. But when we creamed off the top of that list of people, we had about 300 active people who were like really good at what they were doing. So what we did is I asked Michael Hall and David Planella on my team to basically break that group of 300 people up into teams for each of these different apps, and then to do all the boring project management work for them. So we would register all the Launchpad blueprints, we'd have coordinate the meetings, we'd have, you know, figure out what needs to be done, put that into a functional specification, break that into a set of work items, assign that to different people, check in on progress, make sure that things were getting unblocked. So the developers could focus on writing code, which is the fun piece, not on how you manage a software project. We really started in earnest doing this February, March sort of time. We now have all of these applications are on the phone, completely community driven, completely community built. They're just absolutely beautiful. Here you can see the clock and the weather app. And what's been really interesting about this is that while these developers have been building, you know, they started building these apps before the SDK was even released. I mean, we've only got a beta of the SDK right now. So they get to a point where they needed to build a piece of functionality in, but it wasn't done yet. So for example, the weather app wants to be able to detect where you are using Qt location services, and then be able to show you the weather and the location that you're in so you don't have to manually specify it. But the Qt location services was only ready like a week ago. So the requirements of the app developers going through and building these 12 core apps, or 11 core apps rather, was forcing our SDK team and forcing our platform services team, who are building out all the different pieces, to get their different pieces done in time and get them ready for these folks to use. So, like I say, all of these are available on the default image. So if you install Ubuntu on your Galaxy Nexus or your Nexus 4 or something else, then you can access all of these different apps. This, to me, has been such a phenomenal experience working with these people because in many ways, we have two communities that are formed around Ubuntu. One is the our traditional community, which is people who want to build the platform itself, people who want to work on Upstart and the kernel, and they want to work on Mia, and they want to work on all these different pieces. But then there's a whole additional set of people who don't care about the platform. They don't care about the politics of how it's put together. They don't care about, you know, the different arguments and debates around what we do and how we put it together and how we ship it. They just care that this thing that is shipped, they want to write software that runs on it. And this community that we formed around core apps is really part of that second community, which has a very different community dynamic because we can't assume that everybody cares about how the core system is put together. They don't. In our app developer community, there is zero bickering and arguments about the kind of stuff we see in open source, about Mir versus Wayland, about Chromium versus Firefox, all that kind of stuff that's interesting to people who care about how this platform is put together. Most app developers couldn't give a crap about. They just care that it works. And so we certainly, you know, we're not numb to the concerns of the people who do care about the platform. Those are valid set of discussions to have. But we need to coordinate and manage those two different communities in different ways. For those of you who might be interested in writing apps for Ubuntu, one of the things I really strongly recommend you check out is we have a Google Plus Ubuntu app developers community, which is just fascinating. I mean, people post screenshots and videos of what they're working on. It's awesome. In fact, one of the things that we've been working on right now is we have an Ubuntu app showdown that's been running for the last 6 weeks where people can win Nexus 4s and get their apps into the default image. And we have about 40, 45 apps in development, something like that, that are reaching critical mass. In fact, the showdown closes on Sunday. So a lot of these applications are now being, you know, put into the Ubuntu App Store. So when is this going to be ready? In about 5 weeks. I wasn't joking when I said earlier on that we haven't slept since January. It's been a phenomenal amount of work to get to 1.0 of this convergence story. And this is, just to be clear, this is 1.0. This is essentially tagging trunk for 1.0. This won't mean that you can walk into a T-Mobile or an AT&T store and buy a phone with Ubuntu on it. Shippable devices really will come. When we hit 1.0, that's when we can take it to carriers and OEMs and say, this is what it does. This isn't vaporware. This really works. But the you know, to go from essentially what was a demo in January to building out the full system for the phone that's built using real code that can converge across these different systems when we're ready to do that, but also the full application developer platform, developing a new display server with Mir, all of these different pieces, we're on track to have this ready for October for in 5 weeks' time. Most of it's already there. I set up a team called the Ubuntu Avengers a couple of days ago, which is 10 people who are using this thing on a day-to-day basis to file bugs and issues, and those bugs are getting fixed, so we can make sure it's rock solid. I've been using this as my daily phone for like probably 2 months now. And with about 7 minutes to go, I'm basically done. So any questions? Yeah.
What's going to happen with Edge?
What's happened with Edge, Ubuntu Edge? Good question. So for a little bit of a bit of background, Ubuntu Edge was an Indiegogo campaign that we kicked off where we tried to raise $32 million to build one of these devices where you can run Ubuntu on it and you can run Android on it, and then it'll boot a full Ubuntu desktop. And this was a really neat piece of hardware. So $32 million sounded like a lot of money, but it was actually a pretty good deal in terms of the kind of machine that you were going to get for that money. We didn't reach $32 million. Shock horror. we beat like all of the crowdfunding records. We raised more money than any other project with a 30-day kind of thing. Faster to 2 million, all that kind of stuff, but we didn't make the 32 million. So in answer to your question, Ubuntu Edge won't happen. We didn't make the money, therefore it won't be built. Some people have asked, you know, was that a massive failure on behalf of Canonical? Personally, I don't think it was, because it generated so much interest in Ubuntu. It got us into places like, I mean, our CEO went on CNBC. We were on CNN, the BBC, The Verge, like Forbes. You know, all those kinds of places were really interested in the concept of the technology. So I think we raised about $12 million, I think it was. I think we got $12 million worth of publicity out of it. That wasn't the reason why we did Ubuntu Edge. The reason why we did it was because getting, we're kind of ahead of our time. This is going to sound egotistical, but it's not meant to. We're a bit ahead of our time in terms of being able to boot a full Ubuntu desktop on a phone. And when I say we're ahead of our time, it's because a lot of the hardware for doing that doesn't really exist. So, you know, the connectors and all the accessories and things like that. Because the cell phone industry is really, really slow moving. So a lot of that hardware doesn't exist. So the idea with Ubuntu Edge was, well, why don't we just make some of that hardware? And then we can demonstrate what our vision of Ubuntu on these devices is, which is not just that software platform, it's a beautiful device and all the subtleties around that, the sapphire glass and things like that. Any more questions? All right, let's do the guy at the back with a green.
Okay.
Shout.
So one of the things that you mentioned was updating the system on Android versus something like Ubuntu. You guys would be able to push out updates much, much better than one of the major Android makers would. And but my question here is, how do you actually plan on accomplishing that on a large scale? Because you can push it out really easily when the only people using the device are the people who load it onto their existing devices and wipe what's already on it. But in order to get it into a mass market, it's going to have to be on carriers, and you're not going to have to manually install it.
Yeah. Good question. Did everyone hear the question? Or should I repeat it? Okay. So the way in which you'll update your phone which is the same, but the way it's working right now is we have what we call image-based updates, which is essentially when there's a new version of Ubuntu that's ready, the phone will go to a website, it'll check to see what that new version is, and that's literally just a delta between what's on your phone and what's available to download, just like anything else. And then you can download that over the air, over the network and everything else. So the technology that we use to do that is something that we can use to, that Verizon could use or AT&T could use to update their customers with their flavored version of Ubuntu, like with their updates to their applications and things like that. Now, will it be faster? Will it be more efficient with Ubuntu? Just because the technology is there doesn't mean that the politics of the carriers is going to go away. The reason why the carriers are so slow typically is all kinds of liability, mitigation, all that kind of stuff. So I fear that the same slowness will occur in terms of, because that's a policy thing, it's not a technology thing. The technology is there. You could deliver an update every 2 hours if we wanted to. But I suspect that the carriers will still be relatively slow moving in terms of how they deliver that. That's a great question. So the question is are we worried that that a carrier such as Verizon or somebody else could fragment Ubuntu as much as being fragmented with something such as Android? Not really, because we've built, you know, one of the benefits of coming after Android is that we don't want to have the same issues that Android are facing. Where my wife, for example, had an Android phone, I had an Android phone. Completely different user experiences, like completely and totally different. I couldn't use her phone at all, and she couldn't use mine. We've built Ubuntu so carriers primarily they're becoming content companies, and they really care about delivering content out to people. So the Scopes technology that we've got, which is where, you know, you can see it in the dash, so. Hang on, I can't. Let me mirror.
The launcher's on the wall.
It's on the wall. Oh, check it out. Look at that. Hang on. Let me just mirror so I can see. Okay. Hang on. Go away. So, for example, you know, this thing, the dash, right? This shows you content. So, for example, I could search. Oh, there's no network here, so I'm not going to be able to show you. But this thing, you can search for things. I could search for Slayer, for example, and it will show me entries on Wikipedia and all kinds of other places for Slayer and whatever else. This is the way in which carriers will be able to deliver their content. So carriers will be able to choose which applications are in the launcher. They'll be able to theme, like the colors and the look and feel. They can brand it. They can put their own content in there. So if a carrier's got a deal with Netflix, for example, they could deliver Netflix content via the Scopes. That's one of the reasons why we have such great developer experience with the Scopes, is to make it easier for carriers to be able to do that. But the core of the system won't change. So you could have a Verizon phone with completely... This is what happens. The key point here is Ubuntu 13.10. The key point is that if you get like a Verizon phone, the OS will look and feel the same, but the theming, the branding, the choice of applications, the content that's delivered, all of that will change, but you won't have that kind of fragmentation. All right, I think I can do one really quick question. Oh, damn it. I'll tell you what, because we're running out of time, I've got to be off right now. Okay, I'm going to go outside this room. I'm going to answer one more really quick question. If anyone's got any other questions, then feel free to meet me out there. Someone over here? Yeah?
I work for a financial tech company that's paranoid about using phones like Android. And I wanted to know a little bit of an overview of what the security community is like within Ubuntu. How do you invite in the reasonably paranoid to Ubuntu?
How do you invite the reasonably paranoid? How secure is the Ubuntu community or the Ubuntu platform?
The platform.
It's becoming increasingly secure because we now have app confinement. Ubuntu itself is very secure. It's been secure for years. in terms of the system that we ship, you know, ports and things like that. But the, all the app confinement work that we've been doing means that, that applications just can't do bad things that they used to, potentially. So we're less reliant on humans reviewing code and spotting naughty code, essentially. So I think the story that you're going to see with it is going to be, it's going to be a lot better. So, all right. Thank you, everyone.